Welcome to Wagon Wheel. I am Jared Kimber, and this is the Cricket Podcast where we answer your questions. The best way to answer, I don't know the best way to answer questions. I've been doing this show for quite some time as well. The best way to ask questions is to go to patreon.com/Jared Kimber. And there you can put in, you can sign up for Patreon and you can ask questions. And the other way is, of course, if you're watching along live, and you can also look at super chats and even just normal questions. The more comments and questions in the chat, the better, as far as we're concerned. But let's start with the Patreon questions. And it starts with Aditya, who says, which is the worst assembled side, RCB or DC? I would have to go through what... off the top of my head, it feels like RCB, and it feels like RCB because even when we went out and got some good international players like Cameron Green and Will Jacks, there was overlap. And, you know, if you've been following my coverage of the IPL, it's one of the things I hate the most. It's, you know, where Punjab, I also think, could fall into this as well. RCB's problem is they don't have real all-rounders, and so they've been trying to hope that Cameron Green or Will Jacks or Glenn Maxwell can do it. They don't have real strike bowlers. And they don't have a long batting lineup. So off the top of my head, that doesn't sound particularly good. DC's not much better though, is it? There are parts of DC that I kind of like a little bit more. But yeah, there's not much in it, if we're being honest. Aditya says, considering Vivid strike rate in tests and ODIs and high aggregate and average in both formats, do you think he's cricket's most influential batter out after WG Grace and Bradman? Yeah, I think that's probably a fairly good claim. I mean, Trumper probably is there as well because of the strike rate, and Trumper helped open up a cricket field. You know, before Trumper, you hit the ball to the side that it was bowled from, right? And after Trumper, you hit the ball where the gaps were. That's a pretty influential change. You know, Ranji plays a small change, although he was a fantastic batter as well. Grace is obviously the biggest change. And Bradman is sort of takes on what Hobbs does and takes it to another level. And then Viv Richards is... I think I'm right in saying that Sobers doesn't have an outlying strike rate. I don't think there's anyone with an outlying strike rate between Viv Richards and Clem Hill and Victor Trumper. Clem Hill's often forgotten in there as well, but he's a very fast scorer. So it is very different. But when you say influential, who are the people after him who started doing that? And I don't think, realistically, we did see that. So I'm not sure Viv Richards did influence anything. If anything, Viv Richards is probably more like Jeff Thompson, which is someone who no one ever really imitated ever again, right? Does that make them influential? It probably doesn't. Swami Nathan says, how do batters like Head, Rohit, and Klaassen transform into bashers? Is it just a mental adjustment, or does it come with training a certain way? If it's a technique adjustment, will it affect their test game? It can be technical in some cases. Heinrich Klaassen has never made any runs in test cricket. We know he's a fantastic first-class player. Klaassen is the... See, I think Klaassen is a basher, whereas I think Head and Rohit are still playing like themselves and they're just amping it up, which is very different. So they should be able to go between those two things. I think you'd be more concerned if you see batters who consistently start clearing the front leg and start looking at their game differently. I don't know if we've seen someone do that. Liam Livingston, if he'd played more test cricket, might have been an interesting case study on that. Andre Russell, Karan Pollard didn't play. So I wouldn't be too worried. I mean, generally, it sounds weird, but generally having a more attacking mindset, even if you are defending in test cricket, is more handy anyway. So the mental side of it quite often frees you up. And the technical changes, I am sure there are players who have made technical changes for white ball cricket. But if you want to know what the biggest problem usually is for players, it's that they spend a lot more time practicing on white ball than red ball for a certain period. And that's where the drop off is. If you talk to batters, that's what they'll tell you, that they've started working on different skills and, you know, different thinking. And then they find it hard to go between the two. Ian says, just wondered how much or anything you've seen of Kashif Ali. You know my Worcester bias, but he's also a South Asian Cricket Academy graduate who hit centuries in both innings against Warwickshire last week. And have you had much to do with Tom Brown, who was involved in setting up Saka? Did I have Tom Brown on my podcast? I feel like I had someone from Saka, and now I can't remember. Was it Tom Brown? God, I've done so many podcasts, I can't remember now. But yeah, I'm pretty sure I've done an episode on them. Cashier Farley, when he made his hundreds, I looked at the clips. I don't have a huge, opinion on him yet, but he certainly looks like a quality player. It'd be really interesting to see how it goes. I've said this before. I've been talking about this on a podcast, I think, with Bayram in the last couple of days. I really like the idea of finding talent in places where you're not currently finding talent. So South Australian Cricket Academy, they are doing this because the numbers in amateur cricket don't reflect the numbers in professional cricket when it comes to Asian cricketers. Absolutely fine. And I think that's a great idea. But just in general, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender, whatever, I always think that the best places to look are generally the places where no one has before and they've just decided that that doesn't work. Whereas actually you can go off there and you can find new things and you can develop players. It's a perfect situation of something that is untapped. If there's such a high percentage of Asian players in amateur cricket and there's such a low percentage of Asian players in domestic cricket, if I was working for a county, I'd be thinking, I want to find every Asian player who's smacking the ball around a car park somewhere or smacking the ball for an Asian league club that is not in a major league or last man stands or whatever, the non-traditional parts of these things are. My guess is that there is talent there. And, I've talked about this before. One of the reasons I believe this is because I saw the Victorian cricket team do that once and they had huge success. James says, in the recent footmarks on the ICL, you talked about fixing being more widespread than people think. I know it's tough to talk about it without libeling anyone, but is there anything else more you could say about how much of an issue it is? There was a really interesting incident in the NBA recently. Jonte Porter, who's a two-way player, so a supplemental player for a tanking team, there was betting irregularity on his games, and specifically, people were betting the unders, and in those games, he was getting injured very early on and going off. No one is saying he's fixing. No one is saying he was in on the fix. Could just be that someone had inside knowledge that he wasn't doing particularly well and thought he would have a bad game. Could be a multitude of things. But the NBA, who are very, very worried about betting, they've had their own betting scandal with the refs. They quite quickly suspended him so they could look into it. Do you know how many irregularities happen on certain cricketers over and over again? And I've never seen a cricketer suspended. I don't even know if they get asked about it. You talk to people in the betting industry, in the data industry, analysis like me, and we can see patterns that don't make sense. And nothing ever gets done about it. And I do think, and I've said this before, but I do think there is an element of the fact that cricket doesn't report on gambling at all. And there is no, Ed Hawkins would be the closest we would have to a gambling writer. And he kind of writes these days anyway, articles of, who to bet on. There really isn't anyone talking about the gambling industry, which is one reason I've been so interested in it recently. We're watching a game the other day with, 150 million exchange on an English betting platform on an Indian game. 150 million pounds, I should say. So I don't know what that is, 175, 200. Million in USD, and no one's writing about it and no one's looking into it. It's not regulated. The bookmakers in the UK are doing things that they should not be doing, like not paying bets when people make correct bets. Everyone in India is betting, but they're betting through WhatsApp and Telegram into the UAE. All these players, anyone who's ever watched cricket will have seen the ads coming out of Bangladesh, Pakistan, even India at times, for all these people who are associated with these websites that are clearly betting front websites that purport to be news, but they all probably link back to their gambling sites. It's a huge part of our game, and it always has been, and it's not covered correctly. And so in turning a blind eye, you don't stop corruption, you allow corruption. And that is what cricket media is doing. That is what cricket the sport is doing. There has to be a reckoning. There has to be a meeting in the middle at a certain point. Even simple things like it's not just about corruption. It's about there have been betting markets that look odd because people believe that what is happening is money laundering. So one person is betting on one side and then taking a bet from the other person back on the other side straight away just so that they can launder their money. All these sorts of things are happening quite regularly, moving money around. There's so many things happening in the cricket betting markets, but because of what happened in the 90s, instead of there being a whole industry of people looking into this, there isn't. I don't think that it's very hard to write a piece on fixing, but why can't we write a piece on irregularities in the market when they happen, right? I fundamentally don't understand that. So I do think it's a big issue. William says, in the most recent round of Canada Championship fixtures, every game ended in a draw with many blaming the Kookaburra trial. What is it about the Kookaburra that makes taking wickets as it gets older more difficult? And why do counties persist with using it if it produces worse cricket? Well, the counties aren't. It's the ECB that are doing it, William. And it's only a new thing. And there's also a lot of rain. So not exactly sure. What was it? Wasn't it Sussex who said they don't believe in lights, which is the best thing I've ever heard for what is quite clearly it was going to cost them too much money. Kookaburra balls don't have the same kind of lacquer. They're not made in the same kind of way as Duke's. They get soft quicker. They're not hand sewn in the same way. So there's a few, very big differences. They are, to be fair, way better than they've ever been. I would say the last couple of years, since they reinforced the seam with plastic, I would say Kookaburra balls are as good as they have ever been, but I still think a Duke's is a better cricket ball. If you're trying to produce international cricketers, though, just using Duke's probably doesn't make sense because you're only going to use them at home and you're going to use them in West Indies. The vast majority of cricket uses Kookaburra, so there should be a healthy amount of Kookaburra used by English cricketers. I think that makes sense. I still think you keep the Duke's. Obviously, you're still going to be playing with that at home. I don't have an issue with that. But yeah, I do think there should, you have to be smart about this. You have to prepare your cricketers the right way. Satchmo says, would you include a spinner in an all-time West Indies 11 to play a series in Australia or just have four quicks plus sobers to bowl spin? Well, you got Viv as well. I think in Australia, you would probably go with four quicks with sobers as your fifth quick and your occasional spinner. He's probably as a left-arm finger spinner a handy in Australia, but not. He's not going to be a plus. And then you've got Viv Richards to spin the ball the other way. So you do have two part-timers who can get you, well, in Sobers' case, probably 15 overs a day if you need it. In Viv's case, probably 8 overs a day, right? So if you split those up, you take 5 of Viv and you take 10 off Sobers, that's your second spinner, and that allows you to use, what, Garner, Ambrose, Marshall, Hall or whoever, Holding, Walsh, we could keep going here. Whoever you think that other quick is. If you have Walsh and Hall, they're both pretty famous for bowling really, really long spells as well. So you could use that option. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else that they have. And if they had Frank Worrell in that side, I'm not sure if he gets in that side, but if Frank Worrell gets in that side, you've got a little bit more bowling. You can also use Walcott as your keeper in that side, which means you could pick an extra bowler, which meant that you could actually then pick, what's his name with the big hands? Oh my God, I've forgotten his name. But the really good Lance Gibbs, who's the only spinner who would get in. Let's just have a look. That's interesting on Lance Gibbs, just specifically how he went in Australia, because when he played in Australia, the wickets were still helping spinners a little bit more. And so in Australia, he had an average of 33 and economy of 2. So it was his most expensive place. And outside of a couple of tests in New Zealand, it was also the place that he went for. But if you've got an economy of 2, you could certainly get him in. So I think Walcott and Sobers in that side gives you such flexibility. You can go Leary as well if you wanted another, all-round option there. So I think there is some flexibility. I've really gone into I've constructed this side very much. I'll be thinking about this for quite some time. Let's have a quick break. And then after the break, we'll get back with more Wagon Wheel. This is brought to you by Cricket 8. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. We have a partnership with them where we host live watch-alongs, do podcasts and write articles. If you want to know what is really happening with our game, visit cricket8.com. All right, welcome back. Where are we up to? Ben says, is part of the effectiveness of unusual actions such as Bumrah or Malinga that batters cannot predict roughly where the ball will go because they haven't grown up subconsciously learning that action? Or am I overthinking the importance of body language to batters? So it's not about body language. There is a... if you have Chris Wokes or Srisanth or Brett Lee bowling to you, those actions are really... really common. The way that they run in, you know, the way that they prepare, the way that they show you the ball, all these things are really common. And so if you've never faced a bowler like Chris, if you've never faced Chris Wokes before, you have faced bowlers like Chris Wokes before. And you probably faced thousands of balls. Now, maybe he's a little bit quicker or a little bit more skillful than the others, but the basic principles and tenets are all there. You know where the ball is going to be released from, right? It's going to be between the bowler's head and the umpire's head, right? Little things like that. That is, you know where to look. You get a good side of the ball coming in, all these sorts of things. So now let's look at Malinga. So with Malinga, the ball is coming from the umpire's sternum, right? Nowhere near the bowler's head, right? And from an angle that no one else can deliver from. So your everything that you have as the ball is coming out is trying to look up over the bowler, over the umpire's left shoulder. I got confused looking at that reverse image. Over the bowler's left shoulder, and suddenly it's not up here. It's here, right? That's a huge difference. And if you're not used to it, it's really hard. Bumrah is slightly different. So Bumrah's got a couple of things. One is the other thing that you were doing as the bowler is coming in is working out information. And Bumrah is cutting that down with a shorter run-up. So you don't have the same amount of processing time that you would normally have. Then you have the fact that he bowls from on top of his head. It's not a huge difference, and there are more bowlers who do that, but it is a little bit awkward. But the third thing is that when the ball comes out of Bumrah's hand, it travels a shorter distance than any other bowler. So even if you do pick it up and you do process him correctly, he's always going to rush you. The most important thing when you're watching Bumrah is watch how often he rushes people when he bowls at 88 miles and 87 miles an hour. Chris Wokes has to bowl at 92 miles an hour to rush a top-level batter. But Bumrah can do it at 5 miles an hour slower. And that is because of this extra 40 centimeters that he has because he's releasing the ball out in front of him and not from back here. And it means that you're constantly rushing. Anything that is different like that, Akshar Patel, he only had some micro differences from left arm finger spinners. He stayed up a little bit straight. He came from a little bit wider. And that caused all sorts of problems when people started facing him, right? And no one even knew why. It wasn't until Jimenez started looking at it. And then I went a step further as well, using Jimenez to look into more research and look at photos of all these left arm finger spinners. You start to work out, oh, this is actually quite a bit different. You put those changes in. Bowlers who run in holding the ball in their left hand, covering the ball for reverse swing. Like realistically, from a technical point of view, bowlers should never be showing the ball to batters, right? And it's really hard, but that is probably where the future is going to be. You want to keep that information as long as possible. So all those things are really, really important and they play a big part. Bowlers who bowl wide, I think, is it Scott Boland? I might have done a video on once who bowls, doesn't look like he's coming that wide on the crease, but delivers from quite wide, which means that there's an angle coming in that you're not expecting based on the way, on the position in his crease. All those things really do matter quite a lot. And Bumrah is actually another one like that. Vika says, do you think India should pick DK specifically when Hardik and Jadeja are not striking well? Because Pant and Sanju can't play as a finisher. Yeah, it's an interesting one. If Pant plays, they have to change their batting order, right? And they have to think about it quite... I mean, I love Pant, and I think he's the best player of those three. So I would be considering doing that. But DK is probably the best player to just come in at the end. Surely Hardik and surely one of Hardik or Jadeja is going to learn how to hit between now and the World Cup. I could be wrong. Jadeja he's been in a funk for a little while, and Hardik, since he's become an anchor, and he doesn't look fit to me at the moment, and obviously he has confidence issues and everything else. But I have no problem with Dinesh Kartik. If you go back to the last World Cup, I said he failed, but he failed under, I was going to say unique circumstances, but he had a run out, I think. He had an early dismissal. Both of those are fairly common when you come in at the death. And people remember that he didn't make any runs, but there are lots of number sixes and number sevens over a small sample size that don't make runs. So I have no issue with him playing in his current form. But it's not about Dinesh Kartik. It really is about how you are structuring that whole side. Vicar says, I'm surprised that the IPL scoreboard aren't getting much views. Do you think it's because by the time you record, it's very late in India? It is very late in India. There's not much we can do about that. The game's finished very late. I think that plays a small part. We've never got masses of numbers for IPL coverage. We get really consistent numbers for IPL coverage. It's very rare that any of our videos don't work, but it's very rare that any of them pop. And I think the main reason is you're not interested in every single team. I think there's a small percentage of people who are interested in every single team, which is actually a really healthy thing. And most people are interested in their team. That might change as the league gets older and develops a little bit more. So I think that's an element of it. It's not like an Indian match, so we don't get that kind of stuff. But the other thing is that T20 cricket is a lot more disposable. So we just had our biggest World Cup so far has been the 50-over World Cup, right? We've done T20 World Cups and we did okay, but they weren't magnificent. We've done World Test Championships and they've been absolutely fantastic. We've done Series Without India and they've been absolutely fantastic. But the majority of our stuff that works is the 50-over World Cup and the Test matches. And I think the difference is that the narrative sticks around for longer. The end of a one-day game, people are more interested in how that happened and why that happened. So they come back to us. At the end of a T20 game, they go on to the next story. Now, where it goes the other way is that sort of more data-led piece, and the more, I can explain to you how people score and what else do we have? Oh, we had the one yesterday about the Sunrisers score, and I've got one about Sudarshan coming up and, those sorts of pieces. But they are really interested. But it's a small army of people that get interested in that. When you come to the scoreboard, it's on late at night. By that time, the narrative is usually moved to the next game. But there's a really dedicated audience to it. And the other thing is that the numbers of hits are really impressive. Our average view on this channel is 15 minutes, right? There aren't many channels in the world that can boast that. So we are not looking on this particular channel for a huge amount of hits. What we are looking for on this channel is incredible engagement, because those are the two most important things. We think over time, this channel's only, 7-8 months old? We think over time, we will get to 20, 50, 60,000 followers on this channel. And the other one will probably always have a lot more followers because of what it is, and that's fine. But if we can get to 10, 20, 30,000, and we maintain anywhere near around that 15-minute mark, right? Even if it was 12 minutes, which I think it might have been during the World Cup, that's absolutely massive. It's a phenomenally big number. Most major websites in the world, people stay on them for like a handful of seconds, right? So not everything is about just the number of people. And that's a really important thing. Not to get too entrepreneur here, but there are three things that are very profitable to have at the moment. One is people's email addresses, which everyone absolutely loves. The second one is just pure numbers of eyeballs, which of course makes sense. And the third one is engagement time. If you look at what we are doing across our network, it is a combination of all of these different things. That's not an accident. Rudra says, I feel like every year I hear complaints about a lot of drop catches in the IPL. Are there more drops in the IPL than normal? And have there been spikes in drops and what might cause them? I think every year in every single competition I've ever covered, I have had complaints about drops. I can't, you always hear it once. And I did an article about this when England played Australia and they dropped a whole bunch of catches in Australia in a row, or in a short space of time, and Australia didn't drop any. And the important thing to know at that point is that that is going to regress because it is impossible to keep fielding at that bad of a level over a long period of time. But also, if you do them all in a row in the first whatever it was, two tests, chances are you are going to lose those tests and you're going to go behind away from home. And everything also tells us that you're not going to be able to come back from that. I would say every tournament I've ever covered, people will go on and on about how bad the fielding is in a period when there's a bunch of drops back to back. I've never seen any data that suggests the IPL fielding is worse than other tournaments. I couldn't see why it would be. There are probably better fielding tournaments. I think that's probably also true. I know historically fielding, you know, in South Africa, Australia, and probably New Zealand has been a very important thing. And it hasn't been in many other cricket cultures. So I do think that those countries have a natural, you know, advantage there. But, you know, if you're talking about all cricket, I can't really imagine why that would be the case overall. Swami Nathan says, if Tahir and Azam Mahmood can play in the IPL using their South African and UK passports, should players like Baba Azan and Rizwan just buy a citizenship through an investment from a Caribbean county to play in the IPL? Well, they would only do that, right, if they thought there was enough money in it for them not to have to actually go back and play for Pakistan. That's the risk of that situation. So what's Rizwan worth in the IPL? Like Matthew Wade's in the IPL. He's better than Matthew Wade, although not the same sort of power player. But how much better is he than Matthew Wade, right, in terms of value? My guess is that, you know, Matthew Wade probably wouldn't have gone freelance during his career. Now, it's different between Pakistan and Australian wages and everything else. But my guess is that I think it would be too risky. Now, if you had Shaheen Afridi coming through today, is there a possibility that that might happen? I'd like a younger player coming through. Sorry, not might happen, but could happen and would make more sense. Yeah, I can kind of see that, but I don't see it as much with a player like this. And also, they would still have to be accepted. And would they be accepted straight away? Like, it's a really risky proposition. It's an interesting one. We'll take another quick break here on the Wagon Wheel podcast, and we will be back soon with more wagon and more wheel. All right, welcome back. Thanks to everyone in the YouTube. I got Mike here, Naveen, Raul, Keshav is in here again, AB John Harrison, and AZN Fratboy. I like that. Bloody Bugger says, what would happen if the follow-on was made mandatory? Bowlers would sue. Like, if you did it right now, that's what would happen. Bowlers would sue because you're making bowlers do a lot more work in a short space of time without any rest. They would get injured a lot more and they would sue. So there's that. You would also get a lot more wins for the team who has to follow on. There are some. I've always thought, and this is before 2001, I always thought that the follow-on was done too automatically and that it didn't make a lot of sense because there are some times when the conditions are in your favor or you are so much better than the opposition where you just think, we might as well follow on here to end the game early so we can have a couple of days off. Mostly, though, Test match players are pretty good, and if they've failed once, the chance of them failing again in the second innings is pretty low, unless the conditions are massively in your favour as a bowling team. Thirdly, why would you want to tire your bowlers out for that when everyone could have a bit of a knock around in the next innings and go that way? But what I love about the follow-on is it does allow you to get results in games you wouldn't always get results in. It's a fascinating thing of like twisting the order of a game. There aren't that many sports that allow for that kind of movement. And it's a little bit like the, what's the best way of putting it? It's a little bit like the mercy rule, right? Like if a team's that out of it, we don't have to go 4.5 days and wait for this. We can knock this off in 3.5 and everyone can get out of here. So I think there are lots of cool things about it. But with test matches being jammed into small windows, you cannot make it mandatory. And I just don't think that would be fair to any of the bowlers involved. Christopher says, do you think players struggle mentally with living in India for the IPL? Not sure if it's recency bias with players pulling out, but being hotel bound seems a lot harder than other tournaments. No, I think hotel bound is really hard for all tournaments. I think the issue, I mean, Pakistan is the one that I hear the most complaints about, and probably Bangladesh. The problem with India can be the fame. In some cases, especially, you know, if you're, you know, there's so many people, and if they all notice you at once, that can be an issue. I would say that Pakistan is probably the worst because it's really hard for a player to leave the hotel. I'm not even sure if in some tours and leagues you're allowed to. Bangladesh, I've got memory of I reckon it was the England team left the hotel and it caused like three guys left the hotel. Might've been Gareth Batty, Stuart Broad, and might've been Jimmy. I can't remember who the third one was. And it caused all sorts of security issues and whatever. And then they were all, you know, jammed back into the hotel. India is a little bit more flexible and the players can go out. You know, I've met up with players outside of hotels and everything. So I don't think it's that. It is more intense than those other leagues. It is so big and so famous and so talked about that it is a lot more intense in that way. But I don't think it's more intense from a staying in a hotel point of view. GD says, thoughts on the recently concluded USA-Canada T20I series? I mean, USA won that quite comfortably and they picked the best players that are available to them, which is part of the reason that Major League Cricket, you know, exists, is the idea that we will bring players over and they will qualify for the USA and they will get better and they will help the local players get better. I know there was a lot of issues within USA cricket of not wanting to go down this path, especially before a World Cup. It makes a lot of sense to do this. But as I've said before, like the history of cricket is go through the original English and South African and Australian teams. There's a lot of English dudes in those teams. And we just ignore that now. That didn't happen, right? It's always happened in cricket. And, you know, you have had teams like India and Papua New Guinea and you know, that have been a little bit different at times. But cricket develops in different ways in different places. And Corey Anderson is married to an American woman and has lived there for a very long time. I have absolutely no problem with him playing and some of those other players playing as well. And apparently picking those players makes a big difference to the results. If I've got the results right, I think it was 4-0, wasn't it? I think that's right. GD says, how do you think the new New York City pop-up stadium will perform? Who, as in company consultants, et cetera, is in charge of the pitch preparation? I would assume the ICC, because they've been in charge of the last few World Cups, so it would be the same. Will it be a single pitch or a few drop-in pitches? It would probably only be one or two at most. Will it be an extremely flat surface or one that is worn out and unpredictable towards the end? I'll go unpredictable because we have no idea. I think the pop-up stadium will be fine. I worry about the ticket sales and everything else. And I think USA Cricket is in disarray when it comes to their governance at the moment. I would assume the ICC would prefer a batting-friendly surface. Whether, you know, pitchers don't always play ball. I can't believe I said that out loud, but I'm pretty sure that's right. So, yeah, we don't know is the full answer. Bobbio says, have we entered the Travis Head era of cricket? Look, I think Travis Head sort of he played that incredible innings in domestic cricket all those years ago in Australia. Then he really, really struggled, went off. He's certainly improved many parts of his game and is a much better player now than he was back then. But he's going through a phase at the moment, which we saw someone like Nicolas Pouran go through. Teams know how to bowl to you. And they bowl to you that way, and then you revolutionize yourself and you become a different player. And it takes you smash runs everywhere, and it takes a little while to catch up. We're going to know if we're in the Travis Head era if he regresses or if he keeps going like this. That's the difference between the very, very good players and potentially, you know, someone who could reach those great levels. Those great players are always one step ahead or manage to work it out. And the very, very good players eventually, you know, they get pulled back in. James says, following on from my question about Archie Jackson, if you could pick one player to have a 50-plus test career out of Jackson, Jack Iverson or Eddie Gilbert, who would you pick? Eddie Gilbert would be interesting because he bowled like Lasith Malinga or Fidel Edwards, or like a combination between, but very similar kind of action. And I would have thought in that point of cricket before the front foot no ball law, that would be even more dangerous. So I'd certainly love to see him. Plus, he was an Indigenous player who was treated horrendously by, you know, Australia as a cricketer and not as a cricketer. I think he had to get permission from his reservation to leave in order to play cricket. Like, what are we talking about here? And obviously the way he died was very, very sad. Jack Iverson was the original mystery spinner. I suppose you could say Bosie was because of the wrong end, but Jack Iverson was the one that sort of changed everything. And he was the first one we kind of referred to as a mystery spinner. would have been fascinating to see how long he could stay ahead of the game and whether he was the real deal. And Archie Jackson was fantastic. I would probably, from a cricket point of view, I would say Jack Iverson, and from a human point of view, I would say Eddie Gilbert. And James says, as a follow-up to the discussion about Kevin Peterson's clashes with and the eventual exit from the English squad. By the way, baseball has a term for these players, clubhouse cancer. Well, every sport has a play. There's a whole book in New Zealand about, you know, players like this. Can you think of any international players who went the other way and could be fairly assumed to have extended their careers due to positive effect they had on team culture? Yeah, tons. I mean, Ajinkya Rahane was there in part because of his leadership, his fielding, you know, his common sense. And New Zealand have had heaps of those players where if you'd ask a New Zealand player on a moment of clarity if they thought that player was international quality, they would be not sure. But they would say, but here's what this person did and this is why they're important. And there are players who stick around because they get along well with the team. You know, it's not a surprise that people like Dean Jones and Kevin Peterson, their careers kind of ended the way that they did. And then there are other players who stick around a lot longer who probably aren't quite at their level of talent, right? That's the same in any workplace that you've ever come across. Some of these are intangibles. What does Ajinkya Rahane's leadership give India, right? That's a hard one to work out. How important is his slip fielding off spinners? Again, we can maybe get some stats on that, but there isn't as much stats on slip fielding for spinners as there are for other positions, and he probably has more, you know, all these different things. So there are certainly players in that sort of situation. Someone like Jeff Marsh in Australia might be another one that played a lot longer when there were probably other openers who were as good as him. But Jeff Marsh was, again, a very good leader, you know, an interesting thinker on the game, obviously went on to be a very successful coach. Those sorts of things matter as well. But to most of us, we are going to look at just the raw stats because that's what we have access to. And it's very hard to understand those sorts of things from the outside. And also, sometimes people will say he's got a good effect on the culture, but what they really mean is he's my friend and I like him. So, you know, those sorts of things are really, really tricky and it never gets particularly easy. All right, let's have another quick break. When we come back, we'll do the super chats and any other comments I can find in the room. I'm Jared Kimber, and this is The Wagon Wheel. All right, welcome back. I've got a couple of questions. I know the game's about to start, so I'll have to head off in a minute. But let's have a look. ABCD says, would really like to know about your experience of working with Punjab Kings owners. I was involved with them. They owned the Edinburgh Rocks franchise in the European League that never existed. They came up with several suggestions that just didn't make any sense. They had very specific rules of what they wanted that, again, didn't have a lot of common sense involved with them. I don't think it was the entire ownership. I think there was a split, but it wasn't really made clear to me other than they kept mentioning it to me. So I don't even know. Like, it could have been like one partial owner. But yeah, they wanted old finished Indian players ahead of really good international players. They didn't want Pakistani players, which is fine. I think that's normal. They pushed a lot of agendas. I've worked with a lot of owners and it's the same thing. An owner wants something out of their ownership and it might sound weird, but they want to win, but they kind of don't want to win in the same way people on the playing side want to win. The best owner is someone who brings their knowledge to it, but actually gets the experts to do it and then holds them to a certain standard and is diligent. I've never worked with an ownership group like that. So I can't really help. Abhinav says, more dominant away Ashes, Warne 2005 or Smith 2019. I mean, generally you would go with the bowler. That Smith 2019 was pretty fantastic, but and those sorts of things, I'm generally going to go with the bowler, I think. So I'll go with Warne. Lenny says, do you think Aussie Test batting lineup of Uzi, Smith and Marnus going through lean patch will affect Australia's chance in upcoming Border Gavaskar? Do you see any new batters being called up in the playing 11? They've lost to West Indies at home. Of course they're going to have problems with Mohammad Shami and Jasprit Bumrah and Ashwin and Jadeja and whoever else bowls against them. I thought they struggled against Pakistan at times. I don't think at the moment that a most consistent team. they're like a slightly better version of South Africa in that they're so good at bowling that they're always dangerous, but their batting is a little bit weaker. But it's that middle bit that is quite transformative, right? You know, we saw the Cameron Green innings in New Zealand. We know what Head and Mitchell Marsh can do as well. So there are other options available to them that can sort of take you down. The top three, I mean, Usman I'm less worried about because he's made so many runs. Marnus feels like people have worked out how to bowl to him a little bit better. And Smith has to work out a new job. So, I mean, that should be an issue for them. Pass says, last night's question. I have a problem with players like Hardik so blatantly trying to get paid more. Players like Bumrah could easily feel undone. This could fundamentally destroy the league. Bumrah isn't getting paid 7 crore. There's no Indian player that's a star that is getting paid what it says on the tin. There is no major international player who's getting paid what it says on the tin. And I've been told that by Indian and international players. When I talk about how much this person... doesn't matter. There was a couple of years ago, Karan Pollard took a pay cut. And I was like, what? Why would you pay him less? I don't think Karan Pollard got less money. So when you look at stuff like that, it's, yeah. I don't know what the extra payments are. I had one major player tell me that in some cases it's double what your money is. In some cases it can be even more than that. But if you know, the fact that we haven't had a salary cap issue in the IPL so far, again, tells me that the sport isn't covered particularly well. Because I know for a fact that teams aren't keeping to the salary cap. Well, certain teams. Right? I think there are other teams who probably don't pay all that much. And there's also because the contracts and everything else isn't very known, there are ways of paying players outside of their contract. So for instance, you can pay a player an ambassador fee for outside of, and I don't know if this is the case in the IPL, but I know this for a fact in the CPL, because I went through the rules with a fine tooth comb. I can give Karan Pollard 20 grand a year to play for a CPL team. And I can give him 200 grand a year to be an ambassador for my team in the other 10 months of the year. And it doesn't count towards my salary cap. I think I'm one of the few people who've ever written about salary caps in cricket as well, when I talked about the Big Bash one. And the Big Bash was doing dodgy stuff as well. So there's certainly some stuff going on. Shrikant says, Underwood versus Beatty. Contrasting bowling ideologies. Beatty bowled on turners more often. Underwood bowled more often on rain-affected pitches. Yeah, very, very different kinds of bowlers. And they both don't exist anymore, which I find very, very fascinating. Underwood is probably the last of the wet weather pitches bowlers, because wickets got covered after that. And so Underwood didn't have any reason to do that. What we do know about Underwood, though, was that he was fantastic in Australia and was an adaptable cricketer. Like, they say things like he bowled slower in India, which is funny now, because I think if he bowled in India now, he'd probably bowl as fast as possible. So I do think he was a very adaptable cricketer, the way that he went about it. Beatty was incredibly slow. I think Beatty was on the slower end for his era. I think if Beatty bowled now, it would look like a club cricketer bowling at the pace. If you go back and have a look at the clips of Beatty, it's like, why are they not running down and hitting him for six every ball, is what you would be thinking. And they didn't. And so that's why he could bowl the way that he did. Beatty's the best fourth innings bowler we've ever seen. Beatty was very good at adapting to different situations as well. I'd have to go through his full record. I would think that Beatty would be more use to you, because he didn't need the conditions to be wet in order. Although they're both really good bowlers. Beatty's certainly the better one to watch and probably the more interesting one. Underwood might have been slightly better. I'd have to go through all the figures, though, really, really deep, because I think it's a really interesting question. The one thing I would say is I think Underwood would be a really interesting bowler today. Forget limited overs, although I think he'd be interesting in limited overs, but because he did bowl faster and that's become more in vogue, I wonder of the way he bowled, I wonder if he'd be really good on Indian and UAE wickets these days, for instance. Whereas I think Bishan Bedi would really struggle these days in the same way that even someone like Shane Warne would, just because that the slower bowlers just don't have, you know, people just don't stand in their crease and play them in the same way that they used to. It's not to say that Bishop, Beattie and Warne would be terrible now. It's just that the game has evolved beyond some of their skills. They would still be great because of the way they think about the game and the revolutions and everything else. But I think Underwood's game translates a lot better to modern cricket. But yeah, I would have to go through their records for hours to be able to tell you that one. Hypercore says the ICC are using Adelaide Oval's Damien Howe. Yeah, so he did a lot in he's done a lot of stuff with the ICC, and so he's working with New York. And there's an article on Cricket Australia's website. Hypercast always with the facts. William says, does the Kookaburra also struggle in damp conditions in Australia? Even bowling look toothless with it, or are county cricket bowlers just too reliant on the Dukes? Oh, I would assume that Kookaburra haven't made a great ball for these conditions either, whereas the Dukes is aimed towards these conditions. So I think that would be part of it. But I wouldn't take just a handful of matches, as everything. But yeah, you're talking about the difference between a ball that is specifically made for these conditions and another ball that's being brought across. It does get soft. So maybe if it is damp, that doesn't react as well. And last one, Brett Lee said Cummins' middle finger and index finger are the same size. His sister chopped his nail off with a fingertip off in childhood. Does that affect how he uses his fingers for cutters wobble ball? I have heard that, and you have to go back and have a look, but Pat Cummins has talked about this before. I can't remember the exact thing that he said, but I do think he thinks it's a slight advantage. But, you know, you've got, there's so many deformities in major cricketers. So Len Hutton with his arm, for instance. And I asked players if they thought, because I think his left arm was shorter than his right arm. And I thought, well, that actually might make sense from batting. And I asked people if they thought that there was an advantage there, and they're like, no. I was like, okay. Shane Warne obviously was physically incredibly strong in his shoulders because of a childhood injury where he had to drag himself around. Murali had that deformity in his arm. Joffre and Bumrah both have, double flex on their elbows. Was it Glenn McGrath had the wrist that went all the way back? McGrath or something? There was a quick in that era that had the wrist that went all the way back that could snap forward further. All these different things can play a part, in a very small way of helping you find a new method that is slightly different. I can't see how it would help Cummins' cutter because of the way you hold that ball. That shouldn't help it. Wobble ball might be a more interesting one, I would have thought. But I don't know. I would have to talk to Pat Cummins or Jimmy Anderson, one of the world's leading experts, and say to Jimmy Anderson, do you mind if we cut your finger off for a minute so we could see if this affects it? Anyway, that's the end of the Wagon Wheel podcast here today. Thank you to everyone in the chat for coming in live. We got who we got here? Crawler. No, Creator. Yeah. Farhad is in there as well. But big thanks to everyone else for coming in the chat and being involved. And for everyone who listens online, remember to go over to goodareas.co, our website, which has links to all of our videos and podcasts, but also we put up all of our articles there, and you can sign up to your email as well. We have We have a video coming out on Raidu. Very shortly, a player I've always been fascinated with. And also, we just put one up about the Sunrisers almost making 300. So head over to all that. And there's a good couple of podcasts coming up. There's one with the head coach of the Cambodian women's team, and then another one about the French Ghost Leagues with one of the players and the journalist involved in that. So head over there, and that will be great. But I am Jared Kimber, and this is The Wagon Wheel, and I will see you again very, very shortly. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.